Welcome to Broken Law, a podcast about the law, whose interest it serves, and whose it does not. Brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Christopher Wright DeRocher, Vice President of Policy and Program at ACS, and your host for this episode. For the past 21 years, each October, folks around the world have observed the World Day Against the Death Penalty. This international day of action, education, and reflection aims to unify the global death penalty abolition movement and mobilize political leaders, lawyers, advocates, and the general public to support the call for the end of capital punishment throughout the world. This year, the World Day is focused on highlighting the relationship between the use of the death penalty and torture. Critics have long argued that the death penalty is inherently cruel, inhumane, and degrading. Beyond the act of state-sponsored killing itself, many of these critics point to the physical and psychological toll that death penalty regimes exact on those facing execution or the threat of execution, including the death penalty's often arbitrary application, conditions of confinement, and the psychological impact of living on death row, sometimes for years, with the looming threat of execution. Today, I'm joined by John Bessler, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of the book, The Death Penalty's Denial of Fundamental Human Rights, to discuss how the death penalty, once a near universal punishment, has come to be at odds with principles at the heart of international human rights and what effect that has on the shrinking number of countries that retain the death penalty, including the United States. John, welcome to Broken Law.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So I want to start with a little bit of context. As I mentioned in my intro, often the United States, when talking about the death penalty, is discussed as sort of an outlier at this point, particularly among industrialized and liberal democracies. Could you talk a little bit about the change internationally in the death penalty, particularly in maybe like the last half century or post-World War II?
Sure, absolutely. So after World War II, actually, Germany abolished the death penalty in 1949. That was the same year that the Geneva Conventions were passed, which actually prohibited both mental and physical torture in the Third Geneva Convention. And so we've seen since then a number of countries join the abolitionist column. And I think Amnesty International got involved in this issue fairly early on, decades ago. And actually, in 1977, had a big conference, and they issued something called the Declaration of Stockholm, which was a call to abolish the death penalty worldwide. And so ever since then, we've seen a lot of countries, again, join in the movement. And for example, we saw the Constitutional Court of South Africa actually declare the death penalty in South Africa unconstitutional in the mid-90s. So today, China, of course, is the country that has the most executions. We don't know how many because it's a state secret there. But we see a lot of executions in places like Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and we still see some in the U.S. And so U.S. is very much an outlier in that respect in terms of the rest of the world, because the European countries, except for Belarus, have really done away with the death penalty. In fact, in Europe, we have two protocols, Protocol 6 and Protocol 13 to the European Convention on Human Rights, which declared the death penalty first a violation of law in peacetime, and then Protocol 13 addressed it and said you can't use the death penalty even in wartime. So in Europe, we really have an absolute stance against the death penalty.
And the situation is similar in the Americas itself in terms of other countries?
There's been some use of the death penalty in the past in the Caribbean region. We do see, actually, the American Convention on Human Rights is a very interesting provision in it. And that is that once a country abolishes the death penalty, they cannot bring it back under the convention. So it's kind of a one-way street. And so another indication that, again, we're moving away from the death penalty, not back towards it in the Americas. And of course, Mexico and Canada have both gotten rid of the death penalty, so our closest neighbors.
So how does this clear shift away from the death penalty, how does that inform discussions of the death penalty with regard to international human rights and norms?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was in high school, everybody debated whether the death penalty deterred crime or not, and that was the focal point of the debate. But very much now, in the European community, certainly, and elsewhere, as at the UN level, we're seeing a lot of resolutions for the General Assembly to have a global moratorium on the death penalty. We're seeing the death penalty seen through the lens of human rights, And that's where, you know, I've been writing a lot about thinking about the death penalty as torture recently. And again, that has a very clear focus on international human rights, the right to human dignity, the right to life, the right to be free from torture and from other forms of cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment. And to be free from discrimination as well, which is also a universal right.
So the United Nations, I think over the past 15 or so years, has 9 times voted in favor of a moratorium on the death penalty, an international moratorium. And if I'm not mistaken, each time the vote has come up, additional countries have voted in favor of that moratorium. What's the United States record in terms of that voting for or against that particular resolution?
Yeah, the U.S. has not voted for the resolution. That's something that I think very much people would like to see in the abolitionist community. I know there was an effort this past time that Senator Russ Feingold and former Governor Martin O'Malley were actually involved in. They did an event, I think, some of the folks at the National Press Club actually asking the U.S. government to sign on to that. And so that did not happen. And of course, the U.S. still has the death penalty. We have a system of federalism, so we have a number of states that do not use the death penalty, where the death penalty has been abolished, but the U.S. government still has the death penalty on the books, and we have a number of death penalty states, even though the number of executions and death sentences has actually been on the decline, you know, since the late 1990s. We've seen a huge decrease in the number of people sentenced to death and also actually put to death.
I want to actually ask you about that. You know, we talked about the international trends in the death penalty, but even domestically, the trends in the death penalty, if I'm not mistaken, there's a majority of states that have abolished the death penalty in the modern era has occurred in the past couple of decades, and even death sentences, capital prosecutions, and executions have steadily declined in the country. Would you say that, you know, even within the United States, which is a retentionist country, that it's followed in some ways this international trend?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I think you could say it would be fair to say that the progress has been somewhat slow but steady. I mean, again, if you take a look at the UN resolutions to impose a global moratorium on the death penalty, Sister Helen Prejean actually at one point presented, I think, over 3 million signatures to the UN Secretary General, then Kofi Annan, to seek this global moratorium. And we're seeing states abolish the death penalty. Sometimes they've been smaller, medium-sized states that have chosen to get rid of the death penalty. But most recently, we actually saw the death penalty very significantly in the first state in the South, Virginia, which actually historically, because of the association of the death penalty with slavery, the death penalty was often used to kill people that were enslaved. The Virginia legislatively abolished the death penalty. And so that was a very significant moment for the movement because of the history of the death penalty in Virginia.
So I want to turn now to talk about your arguments and others' arguments about the death penalty and torture, and particularly with regard to international human rights and norms. And first, I want to ask you, what are the sort of controlling documents or informing documents that sort of would lead folks to say that the death penalty, as it's administered, does actually qualify as torture?
Yeah, so international law, there's a number of instruments. There's a lot of things out there. And I think we would start with World War II and the aftermath of World War II, where we see the United Nations Charter, 1945, and then we see the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. And that was a significant moment. And actually, in that document, Universal Declaration, Eleanor Roosevelt was actually very involved in the drafting of that at the UN level. And she actually convinced the drafters to eliminate a reference to the death penalty. There originally in the draft, there had been a reference to the death penalty. And I think she thought, and I think appropriately so, that a reference to the death penalty in a document about universal human rights would kind of mar that document. And she also recognized there was a movement afoot even then to abolish the death penalty. So some countries had already gotten rid of the death penalty, but not very many countries had abolished the death penalty by the time that the Universal Declaration was put in place. And so from there, we have a series of conventions and covenants, and this is where the debate kind of is engaged on international law, because we have first something called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the U.S. actually signed on to. The U.S., when it signed on to that, document, which prohibits torture as well as cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and punishment. The U.S. entered reservations to that treaty, saying that they signed on to the treaty, but they were reading it in a way that was consistent with the basically the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And the Eighth Amendment, as your listeners will know, is what prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. And the 14th Amendment has a due process clause, but also equal protection of laws clause in it as well. So in Article 6 of this International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, sometimes called the ICCPR, the death penalty was reserved for the most serious crimes in Article 6. There were some limitations on the death penalty in Article 6, but essentially the ICCPR allowed the death penalty's use in that. But at the same time, it prohibited torture in a different article. And so my argument is essentially that the death penalty has been misclassified in the past as something that's non-torturous in nature. And I believe the death penalty should be properly classified as torturous in nature because of the fact that the death penalty inherently, an immutable characteristic of the death penalty, is that it involves the use of death threats. When you have a capital charge that's brought against somebody, that's the use of a death threat. When you have a death sentence, that's just a more credible death threat that exists. And then as you get closer and closer to the execution, as the execution becomes more imminent, the death threat becomes more and more real. And one of the things that we see already in international law is that a mock execution, that is a simulated execution, and we're seeing these actually put to use against some of the Ukrainian soldiers who were fighting against Russia in the invasion, the unlawful invasion of Ukraine, is the mock executions are already classified as torture under international law. So if a simulated execution is torture, then one has to ask, well, what about a real one? Because it has all the characteristics of a mock execution, but it's then carried out at some point if you're actually going to have the death penalty. And so that's essentially the argument. And so if we can go back in history a little bit, back in the 18th century, when the America's founders ratified the Constitution and debated and ratified the Bill of Rights, the founders were very much against torture. But torture back then was seen as something that was actually used in continental Europe, in what we call the civil law system, where it was actually judicially authorized torture, where there was an attempt to get a confession before you could punish somebody. And so even though the English common law actually prohibited torture and renounced the kind of torture that we saw in the civil law countries in, say, France and Germany, torture was not seen as including the death penalty. The death penalty was kind of seen in a separate legal silo from torture. But the modern definition of torture now includes both mental and physical forms of torture. And under the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which went into force in 87, we see that mental and physical acts of torture are prohibited by law, including for punishment. And so really what's been happening is that the definition of torture has broadened, I think appropriately so, but the U.S. Supreme Court continues only to focus on the aspect of will there be physically excruciating pain at the moment of death, and has entirely ignored the other half of the definition of torture, which is psychological torture, which, you know, if you look at what's happened in the United States, for example, we see Richard Glossop in Oklahoma has already faced 9 different execution dates. He's still alive. I think there was a story I saw that said he'd ordered 3 last meals and eaten 2 of them, and his executions were called off at the last moments. We see Julius Jones case, which got a lot of attention in the news. I think he received a commutation from his execution day just literally hours before his planned execution, putting his family members at risk of him being executed. And there's claims of innocence in that case. And most recently, there was a case in Idaho, actually. A judge just in early August of this year, 2023, allowed a death row inmate's claim to go forward past a motion to dismiss. There's been no ruling on the merits yet. But in that case, the state of Idaho was scheduling executions when it knew that it didn't really have the drugs available to carry out the executions. And so the judge in that case has allowed an Eighth Amendment claim of cruel and unusual punishment to move forward into the court system. So you may be hearing more about that case in the future.
those are some particular extreme cases, but it's not unusual, right, for folks who are facing an imminent execution to be submitting petitions, particularly to the U.S. Supreme Court, in hopes of preventing an execution. And those decisions by the Supreme Court happen at the last minute. So it's the normal course of these executions for folks not to know whether or not they will actually be facing death minutes before it may happen, right?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I mean, the U.S. is not alone in this kind of uncertainty that people face at the end of their incarceration. Of course, we've had people being exonerated within days of their scheduled executions as well. So we know that exonerations, a number have occurred, literally, you know, I think that the number is close to 200 exonerations have been documented from death row in the United States since in the modern era, so really the 1970s. So you have this uncertainty, but in Japan, they actually don't tell the inmates there that they're going to be executed until the morning of. So, and people there spend, you know, sometimes decades on death row. So literally every day of the life of a death row inmate in Japan would be spent wondering, is this the day that they're going to execute me? And so there's actually a challenge to that in Japan, legal challenge that was filed, I think, about a year ago. I'm not sure what the status of that is right now, but it's an issue around the world, that this uncertainty that people face when they're sentenced to death. And again, that's part of the problematic nature of the death penalty itself and the government's involvement in it. So to qualify as torture under international law, you're talking about an official act, so a state actor that's engaged in this practice. And of course, people think of torture maybe in the way that they might see it, like in a James Bond movie, kind of physical act of torture. But the psychological torture is also absolutely prohibited under the Torture Convention. And there's actually no exception. You can't torture somebody even in wartime, threat of war, public emergency. There's no exception. It's an absolute bar on torture. In fact, torture under international law is considered what's called a jus cogens norm, a peremptory norm of international law. So it has the highest level of protection against torture alongside things like genocide. And so there's no exception. So, but if you look at the non-state actor context, there's actually some case law in Alabama, which is a death penalty state, where for purposes of criminal cases, where there's a non-state actor who's committed a murder, they define psychological torture in those cases for the purpose of aggravating the nature of the murder. And they define psychological torture in those cases as making somebody aware of their impending death, and then the person not having any ability to prevent that death. And so if you apply that same definition of psychological torture, which I think is reasonable, to the death penalty context, you know, you have people that are not just facing a threat of death and being helpless to prevent their death for, say, a half hour or an hour, but the average time that people are spending on death row subjected to this kind of continuous threat of death is about 20 years now. And so, you know, in thinking about the death penalty as this systematic use of death threats, which in any other context we would not allow. If you had an interrogation of somebody and you got a confession from them, in the old days, they referred to this as the third degree. If you were to torture somebody to get a confession, the courts would say, no, that's not admissible. That is a coerced confession. And we know that people that have been charged with the death penalty, who face the death threat, the Death Penalty Information Center has actually documented some cases where people have falsely confessed. And so we know the practice of threatening with death is something that causes people to do things they would not ordinarily do. And we also know that death threats are ordinarily unlawful. So, right, these are ordinarily criminal acts. These are tortious acts. People facing death threats could sue somebody for intentional infliction of emotional distress under U.S. tort law. And so if we think about the idea of the rule of law and universal human rights, we have to think that, you know, we don't truly have universal human rights unless we protect everybody from torture. And actually, that's what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says. It says no one shall be subjected to torture, a cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment. And so if you're going to stop torture, you have to not only protect the innocent, but also protect people who are guilty from torture as well. And that's part of the commitment that the U.S. really made when it entered into the U.N. Convention Against Torture. And the U.S. took some time to ratify that convention. It wasn't ratified until the 1990s. But we did make that international commitment. And my point is just that I think that the death penalty has been misclassified as a non-torturous act when it has all the characteristics of torture because it makes use of death threats. And so that would be the central point I would try to get across on this podcast.
I would also say, I mean, to some extent or to a large extent, proponents of the death penalty, I think, in their arguments for retention, would note the sort of coerced confession almost as a feature, not a bug of a death penalty regime. Like often it's argued that the threat of a capital prosecution will encourage a defendant to agree to a plea deal and therefore save the state the expense and trouble of a trial. And so this is a good thing. It's a thing that we can use as leverage. But your argument is that kind of leverage is in and of itself psychological torture.
Yeah, I've heard that argument. And, you know, I teach, one of the classes I teach in addition to teaching a course on the death penalty is contracts. And there's a case, for example, where in New Jersey, where there was a husband and wife, they'd become estranged. The man brought a claim. He had transferred all his property to his estranged spouse. Her father was in prison in Pennsylvania for an arsenic poisoning ring. And so the idea of a threat of death was ominous in this exchange, property exchange. And the judge in that case said, well, we're going to have a hearing about, has there been duress in this case? And again, if you had a contract that was procured through duress, like a commercial contract, for example, the courts would set that aside because if you point a gun to somebody's head and say, sign this contract or else, that clearly is something that's impermissibly coercive. And so the point I was making about some of the law enforcement interrogations, if those stray into the land of making death threats against somebody, the courts are going to look at those and say, no, those aren't going to be admissible. We can't rely on those because the person was under a threat of death. And so similarly, we know that there have been cases where people have actually falsely confessed. I think people in the past used to think, well, who would falsely confess to a crime they didn't commit? But we actually know now that that happens with some regularity where people are faced with extended periods of interrogation. They just want the interrogation to end, or where they're faced with an actual death threat. They have confessed in the past falsely. We know that now because of DNA evidence and other things that we can verify that people that have been put on death row were actually not guilty of the crime. And so I think it's short-sighted to think that you can decide which those cases are and make use of death threats in a situation where, again, you know that it's going to produce some false confessions over time. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, the whole idea of the rule of law is that nobody is above the law and that everybody is subject to the same laws. And so when we have governments, right, that very appropriately prohibit death threats, right, make that a criminal act, we shouldn't have the government officials then themselves making death threats against other people to accomplish something in a criminal justice system. And we don't need the death penalty. Again, we see Europe hasn't had the death penalty for many years now throughout Europe because they've signed on to these international human rights protocols. And there's just not a need for the death penalty. And again, we've seen the numbers of death sentences decline in the U.S. We've seen the number of executions decline. And actually, on average, non-death penalty states in the U.S. tend to have lower homicide rates. So again, we don't need to make use of death threats, and we can honor our commitment to the Convention Against Torture and to universal human rights at the same time that we protect ourselves and actually keep people safe through effective law enforcement.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
Something else that you touched on that I want to circle back to is the rough estimates for folks who are on death row in the United States is generally about 20 years between sentencing and execution or death or removal from death row. And death row itself and the conditions of confinement for people who are on death row are particularly harsh. Could you talk a little bit about how those conditions of confinement and that period of time of waiting, how that plays into arguments that the death penalty regime as administered is torturous?
Sure. There was a report issued a few years ago, University of Texas did a report. It's called Designed to Break You. You can find it online. And the whole point of that report was to look at the conditions of confinement. And again, you picture a cell that's about the size of a parking space. And in some places, we've seen on death row, no air conditioning in the South, temperatures above 100 degrees. And again, people that have ended up on death row have ordinarily done very bad things, right? These are heinous crimes we're talking about. But we also know that there's probably some innocent people on these death rows. And so people need to think about that as well, that you have somebody that's been not only wrongly accused of a crime, but wrongfully convicted of a crime who's actually spent time on death row. And so they're all intermixed together, right? So, and if we think about the conditions of confinement, there was actually, thinking about international law, there was a case that was decided by the European Court of Human Rights many years ago where in Virginia, they refused to extradite somebody to Virginia without assurances that the death penalty would not be sought because of the conditions of confinement on Virginia's death row at the time. Again, Virginia's now abolished the death penalty. And many countries are actually refusing to extradite people to the United States because of the possibility that they might face the death penalty. So this has become a regular kind of aspect of extradition proceedings that countries like South Africa, like in European Union, simply refuse to send people to the U.S. without assurances the death penalty would not be sought. And so it's actually hindering law enforcement to that extent. But I would say that this has been called the death row phenomenon, that the idea of spending decades on death row when you're facing a death sentence, oftentimes in solitary confinement. There's been a lot of suicides on death row. There's been a lot of people that actually mutilate themselves on death row. And so, you know, this is something that aggravates the torture of the death penalty. But again, an immutable characteristic of the death penalty itself is it involves use of death threats. And so even if you were to make the moment of execution physically pain-free, which I doubt one could really do because, you know, the intermixing also of psychological harms and physical harms, very hard to separate. But you cannot eliminate the fact that there's a death threat that's associated with the death penalty. And so no matter how many different methods of execution you try or you go through, you can't eliminate the central fact of the death penalty, which is it makes use of death threats as part of its process. And those death threats in other contexts have been considered to be torturous in nature, and they've also been considered to be, and there's actually lower court cases on this, for example, in the United States, where like a prison guard threatens somebody with a revolver, cocks it to the person's head. Those are considered violations of the Eighth Amendment as well. So the Eighth Amendment protects not just against physical harms, but also against psychological harms.
So I want to touch on something else that I think could potentially impact the human rights issue in this area, which is, you know, I think many critics of the United States criminal legal system point to the disparate treatment and disparate outcomes for people of color, particularly Black people. Our federal death row is certainly Black men are overrepresented and people of color in general are overrepresented. What role does discrimination, particularly racial discrimination, play in the evaluation of the United States death penalty regime in a human rights context internationally?
Yeah. When you study the death penalty, you cannot separate the death penalty from the issue of race. These are intertwined throughout our history. And if you look at the way the death penalty was used in the past, and let's take Virginia for an example, which I talked about earlier. There was something called Gabriel's Rebellion. Gabriel was just trying to get his freedom and tried in 1800, initiated a rebellion, which was quickly put down. And many people were actually executed as a result of that rebellion, where Gabriel and his cohorts were simply seeking freedom. And there was a correspondence between Jefferson and Governor Monroe at the time about, you know, when is it appropriate to stay the hand of the executioner? If we look back at the history in the United States, there's been a lot of debate about the death penalty for, you know, for decades, for centuries, really. And we go back to the Enlightenment. That's when people really started advocating against the death penalty. But throughout that time, the death penalty was regularly used against minority groups to carry out executions. And it was also, you know, used in ways to persecute religious groups. In England, for example, you have execution of a lot of Catholics in England, and the Protestant Catholic divide that consumed Europe after the Protestant Reformation led to many executions on both sides. People would be drawn and quartered, but there were just horrific executions. And so in the United States, I grew up actually in Mankato, Minnesota, which was the site of the largest mass hanging. We had 38 Dakota Indians that were hanged on the day after Christmas in 1862. And if we look at the statistics, we had a lot of race of the defendant discrimination early on in our history. Now we have more discrimination based on who the victim is. It turns out that if you're Black and you kill someone who's white, you're much more likely to get the death penalty in the United States. And so when you look at the death penalty, you really can't separate out the issue of race from capital punishment. And actually, if you actually look at where most lynchings occurred, and you were to superimpose a diagram of where most executions occur, you see a lot of overlap there between where mostly Black men were lynched and where you see people being executed.
Somewhat relatedly, and I wonder the extent to which this can be connected to arguments around the torturous nature of the death penalty, particularly in the United States, is the arbitrariness of its application. You know, obviously, with fewer jurisdictions having the death penalty, it can very much depend on like what county in like what state you are in when you are and you're accused of a crime, in addition to who you're accused of killing and who you are. Could you talk a little bit about like how arbitrariness and just like who knows who's going to get this penalty?
Yeah, no, I had a chance a few years ago to edit a book, and it was actually the Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent in the Glossop versus Gross case. I already talked about Richard Glossop's case, but this was a case where Justice Breyer, who's now retired from the court, joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's joined Justice Breyer's dissent. So the two of them, they specifically spoke about this issue of arbitrariness and the unreliability of, you know, the system that we're seeing. And they actually included a county by county map of where executions are occurring. We see some clusters here and there, but there's many counties that never use the death penalty. It's a very small number of not just states that use the death penalty in the United States now, but a small number of counties within those states. So who gets the death penalty has a lot more to do with what kind of lawyer they had, or the geography of where the crime was committed, or the issue of who was the murder victim, what was the race of the defendant, than it does with thinking about the nature of the crime. And so, you know, if you think back to 1790 period, right, where we have the first like Federal Crimes Act, which authorized the death penalty in U.S. law, and of course the states were still using the death penalty as well. There was a lot of discussion about the death penalty debate, but they were still using it. The death penalty was the mandatory punishment for various crimes. So if you committed that crime, the statute generally said you shall be put to death. We moved to discretionary sentencing. And once you move to discretionary sentencing, of course, you're going to end up with much more arbitrary punishments because you leave it up to individual decision makers and individual cases. And then you allow issues of, you know, racial prejudice and bias, for example, to creep into those decisions. And again, we cannot separate out the issue of racial discrimination from the issue of arbitrariness. It's a much more invidious form of arbitrariness where you're actually sentencing someone to death based upon basically the color of their skin. And one thing that people may not know much about is that the cruel and unusual punishments language is in the U.S. Constitution, the Eighth Amendment. But the cruel and unusual punishments language was not only in the Constitution. If you look at states that had slavery in the South, there were laws that prohibited somebody from treating a slave in a cruel and unusual manner. But these were perverted in the sense that slaveholders were using, like whipping, for example, corporal punishments so brutally against the people that they had enslaved that it was the usual punishment. And so in Southern states, there was laws, for example, that prohibited somebody from treating a slave with unusual rigor. But because everybody was brutally whipping their slaves, that was used as basically a defense for them to say, we're not doing anything wrong. And so that's just the most perverted way of thinking about that. And so the association of the cruel and unusual punishments language with that with that blatant and overt forms of racial discrimination is something we need to think about in our history as well.
So I want to turn back to the UN Convention Against Torture. You touched on this earlier, but I want to focus on it a little bit more directly. The convention itself includes an exception for quote unquote lawful sanctions. I think some could read that as a loophole big enough to drive a truck through, perhaps. And certainly, I think critics would say, well, in the United States, in certain jurisdictions, the death penalty is a lawful sanction, and therefore this convention does not apply. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's case law. For example, there's case law in the Ninth Circuit, which says that to be a lawful sanction, the sanction itself cannot be torturous. And so the first response is basically, I think you need to figure out if a punishment is torturous by looking at the characteristics of the punishment itself, not how the punishment is characterized by others. And that, again, the core characteristic of the death penalty involves use of death threats, credible death threats, which ordinarily are considered torturous in other contexts in the law. Now, it is true that this lawful sanctions exception was written into the Convention Against Torture, and a lot of countries used it to basically allow themselves to continue to use what I consider to be torturous practices, like the death penalty. Sweden, actually, when they were debating this convention, tried to get incorporated into the definition of torture and then discussing this lawful sanctions exception, what are called the UN minimum standards for treatment of prisoners, which now called the Mandela rules, which actually prohibit corporal punishments. So corporal punishments being that would be a non-lethal punishment within prison. And of course, in the US, we've abandoned non-lethal punishments. In fact, if you look at a case that Harry Blackman wrote when he was on the Eighth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, called Jackson versus Bishop in 1968, he described the lashing, the whipping of prisoners in Arkansas as degrading both to the punisher and to the punished alike. And so, you know, when you have non-lethal corporal punishments already being declared a violation of the Eighth Amendment, and of course, if the U.S. were to simply declare the death penalty unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment, it would immediately become unlawful throughout the country. So the lawful sanctions exception, I think your analogy was right. The countries have used this as a way, like a truck, you know, driving a truck through something to allow themselves to continue these, you know, what I consider to be very barbaric practices. So there's been a lot of objections over the years to that language because there are still corporal punishments that are being used in like the Middle East, for example. We still have amputations, like hand amputations occurring in places like Saudi Arabia. And so, again, I think you need to look at the characteristics of the act, not how people characterize it, because human rights abuses often occur where people try to use euphemistic language about a human rights abuse to try to justify it. So instead of using the term waterboarding, which people associate with torture, right? People referred to it as enhanced interrogation techniques, right? Well, it doesn't change the fact that it's a torturous practice to use waterboarding to try to secure a confession. And again, as I think we move forward, the other thing we have to remember is that in many places where the death penalty was once lawful, it's no longer lawful. And so even within the United States, you know, we have 23 states at this point that have abolished the death penalty. We have actually 90 countries now that have signed on to what's called the second optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is aimed at abolishing the death penalty. As you mentioned, we see even more countries signing on to the UN General Assembly moratorium resolution, seeking a global moratorium on the death penalty. And as I mentioned, in the Americas, in the way this American convention works, once a country abolishes the death penalty, they can't bring it back. So you're never going to have kind of a rebound that way in those countries. In the U.S., it's more complicated because we have a system of federalism. So you have individual states that have to make this decision to abolish legislatively. You have the U.S. government involved. But the U.S. Supreme Court, if it declared the death penalty a violation of the Eighth Amendment, just as South Africa's constitutional court did back in the mid-1990s, it would no longer be lawful. And actually, there's already a U.S. statute that essentially prohibits mock executions, considers that to be an act of torture. So again, I think people need to take a look at this issue and rethink how they're thinking about the death penalty and the lens they're looking at it through. And I think the focus on torture with the World Day Against the Death Penalty is a good opportunity to do that, because I think people are thinking about it in a much different way. They're looking at it through a human rights lens And the more we talk about it in that way, I think the more people will think about it in that way.
So ultimately, in your work connecting the death penalty with torture under international human rights norms, what's the goal? Is there an enforcement mechanism that you want to see applied to states that continue to use the death penalty? Is this more about sort of a moral shaming of countries that retain the death penalty? What do you think the way forward is here?
Yeah, I mean, my goal, I would like the United States to be a leader in human rights. I mean, we were heavily involved in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we're seeing the number of executions and death sentences decline. It's largely now limited to very limited geographic areas, not just within states, but within particular counties where we have clusters of you know, prosecutors seeking the death sentences in particular places. We have, like in California, we have a very large death row. I think it's over 700 people on death row, but they're not using it. It's become a very symbolic kind of thing. And because most death sentences and executions are actually not occurring in the United States, once we abolish the death penalty, we're in a much better position to call to account countries like China and Iran and Saudi Arabia to say, look, this practice is unacceptable. And in many of these countries, it's not just people convicted of crimes that are being executed. It's dissenters, people that are raising issues with tyrannical or oppressive or authoritarian regimes. And so if we can just get rid of the death penalty here in the United States, and again, the death penalty is a small part of the criminal justice system. I like to refer to it as kind of the tip of the iceberg. But if we were to get rid of the death penalty, we open up also conversations we can have in the criminal justice system about other aspects of the criminal justice system, racism within the system, for example. You know, the only way you can really honor the spirit behind the Eighth Amendment, this prohibition against cruel and unusual punishments, is to get rid of the death penalty. I like to say that right now that the Eighth Amendment has a kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde quality to it, because ordinarily the Eighth Amendment is designed to protect people from harms. You have to clothe prisoners, you have to feed prisoners, you have to give them at least adequate health care. And on the other hand, the death penalty turns this Eighth Amendment into this very vengeful, non-protective legal protection. So I think that contradiction can really only be resolved once you decide to get rid of the death penalty. And actually, interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court has already held that the Eighth Amendment prohibits torture. Now, ironically, they did that back in the late 19th century in two death penalty cases, where they approved the electric chair and public shooting of people. But what's happened since the late 19th century is that the definition of torture has broadened to include psychological torture. And the Supreme Court simply has not kept up with the times in interpreting the actual definition, the modern definition of torture, which everybody now agrees upon, that's actually in the UN Convention Against Torture. And again, there's those cases I mentioned that say, to be a lawful sanction, it cannot itself be torturous. And that makes sense, right? Because you wouldn't want to have a system where Kim Jong-un in North Korea can do whatever he wants and says, well, it's lawful because I said it was lawful. That doesn't make any sense. You have to look at the characteristics of the punishment and then determine objectively, is that punishment torturous or not?
So we're about to wrap up, John, but you know, I think a lot of our listeners are very engaged, very concerned about this issue. So I'd ask you, is there anything that folks can do, whether lawyers or non-lawyers, to sort of engage in this issue and to move it forward that you would recommend?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things people can do. I mean, there's organizations, National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. If you want to follow developments in the death penalty, there's the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington, D.C., that you can follow developments and see what's going on. For lawyers, if you're at a law firm, you want to consider taking a case. The ABA has a death penalty representation project. They're always looking for lawyers to take on cases in that venue. And then there's just talking to people about this issue and maybe writing about it, exploring what's really going on. I think one of the things about the death penalty is that because there's a lot of people on death row, but compared to the population, it doesn't affect a lot of people directly. And so the more attention can be brought to this issue, the more we can focus on getting rid of the death penalty throughout the United States. And then I think we're in a much better position to take on these human rights abuses that are occurring around the world that we know are occurring. And again, China doesn't even keep track of their statistics. We have no idea how many people they're executing. But until we get our own house in order, get rid of the death penalty, it's going to be very difficult for us to be even, you know, raising these kinds of issues internationally, because we're using the practice. So I think we need to take a long look at this and think about it. And again, torture is about what the person inflicting it is doing. It has nothing to do with what the person did in the past. It's about what we're doing. And so whereas the crime is about what the offender did, and again, we need to have a just system of punishment, but the punishment is about what we're doing. And are we going to bring ourselves down to the level of using death threats to carry out and enforce our criminal laws? And I really think that's a mistake, and that we there's a better way. And I would encourage people to look at that and think about that.
Thank you so much for joining us, John. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I appreciate your time today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
And thanks to our listeners for finding Broken Law. Please be sure to follow and subscribe to Broken Law so you don't miss any episodes. And please recommend Broken Law to a friend so we can bring these important conversations to more listeners. You can find details and show notes about today's episode on our website at acslaw.org. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose does not.